without having to be stressed about working from paycheck to paycheck, to actually enjoy what's going on here. Some sectors of the city really enjoy it, but others are being forced out very quickly with the development that's happening. I don't think that we're taking environmental justice seriously either. I think that Portland has a reputation of being a green city, but when you actually look at it, it's quite a polluted city, and that people who are historically marginalized take the brunt of that pollution, and that there's not a lot of effort to redress that. The third major issue that's going to get attention is the police. I think that there's not enough police oversight. We need to have independent police review boards that can actually investigate, subpoena, and discipline officers, including dismissing them for conduct. And I'm very wary of this policy that's coming in where they're going to have officers be talking to people on the streets, is how it's sort of framed, because I think it looks a lot like stop and frisk, and so these things need to be given far more attention. On Friday, when I get to do a press conference in City Hall, I'm going to unveil the full platform, and that will have a lot to do with the question that you're asking right now.
You've been interviewed by KABU many a time on many a matter, but I'm not sure if you've ever been given an opportunity to share with our listeners kind of a brief bio of you. Can you talk about the journey in between growing up in Southern Oregon and how you get to being both college professor and activist here in the metropolitan area?
Like you said, I grew up in Southern Oregon and moved to Portland to go to school at Concordia University. And I was very lucky to have mentorship from very progressive professors. I studied biology, but I was also politically involved and learned enough to figure out that things weren't exactly right in the world. And I came to political maturity when George Bush was president as well, so that heavily influenced the way that I saw the world. After I got out of college, I decided rather than to pursue science, that I would go into law. I learned a lot, but most of the experiences that had strong impacts on me were jobs that I had while I was in law school, and one of those was moving to India to work at Vandana Shiva's NGO, Environmental and Poverty Rights for People, in Delhi and around rural India. One of the campaigns was the displacement of the poor in Delhi. Basically, the process had been that corporate farming had driven local farmers off of their land, and with nowhere to go, they would come into the city, and then they would be forced to basically live in shanty towns. And then whenever the city decided that it wanted the clothes modernized, they would basically bulldoze these shanties and push people out. So there's this position where people have nowhere to go. They don't have jobs. They don't have livelihoods. They're pushed off the land. They've got nothing. And that left a really strong impression on me. And I see that as a trend that's happening everywhere in the world, including the United States. I got to work in the federal court system and see how that works. I got to work for the Oregon Department of Justice and see how that works. After law school, I moved to the Netherlands and studied technology policy. I got to experience what a country that gives a social safety net looks like. So I had student insurance, 40 euros a month. I had almost full health insurance. And as a citizen of my own country, I couldn't come close to anything like that. On Friday, when I get to do a press conference in City Hall, I'm going to unveil the full platform, and that will have a lot to do with the question that you're asking right now, but more or less.
I've been talking with Nicholas Caleb. He is a candidate running for Dan Zaltzman's city council seat. Reporting for KABU News, this is Robin Ryan.
The co-founder of Right to Dream 2 Houseless Rest Area, Ibrahim Mubarak, has had his court hearing delayed until April 4th. Mubarak was arrested recently while trying to assist houseless individuals sleeping under the Burnside Bridge. At today's Portland City Council meeting, Christopher Meisner gave testimony regarding Right to Dream 2, recent sweeps of houseless people, and the Thetis Corporation that has been contracted by the city to create a digital database and tracking system of the city's houseless population.
I'd like to talk to you guys today about the sweeps that are happening, and they just need to stop. They really do. I mean, in my opinion, it's a violation of human rights. Back in the 90s, a federal government came down and audited the city and slapped a big fine on the city for overpopulation of the jails, people sleeping on the mats, for a violation of human rights. It's basically the same thing out there on the street. I mean, all they're doing is sleeping. Also, I'd like to talk about Incutel and this Thetis program that's going on. They got a big grant and brought the CIA in to surveil the houseless. And my opinion, that's, who's going to end up paying for that? The taxpayers. It's another way for the city to make money off the homeless, in my opinion. It's just, and I looked at this, Commissioner Reese's Prosper Oregon, and there is no help there. There is sweeping them aside, casting them aside, pushing them out, and I ain't helping nobody. I wish more people on the city council here would act and make decisions with a degree of morality, okay, more than Ms. Fritz. I wish more people would look at it at more angles with a degree of morality rather than let's make a buck.
That was test.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was testimony from this morning's city council meeting in Portland about the Right to Dream 2 houseless rest area and the ongoing harassment of people who live on the street. The court hearing for Right to Dream co-founder Ibrahim Mubarak will be on Friday, April 4th, and supporters will gather outside the courthouse on Southeast 4th and Salmon in Portland.
Controversy continues over the proposed Portland police brutality settlement, as community groups submitted their proposals for amendments to the settlement before a deadline yesterday. Groups like the Albina Ministerial Alliance contend that the proposed settlement doesn't go far enough. This settlement is a result of the 2012 Department of Justice investigation into police brutality after numerous incidents of excessive use of force against people of color and the mentally ill in the last few years. Both the Portland Police Association and the city deputy attorney believe that the settlement is reasonable and provides adequate means for police reform. The city attorney claims that in addition to the provisions in the settlement, officers can always be fired for inappropriate conduct. There is, however, no precedent for this. The closest an officer has ever come to being fired for excessive use of force was Ron Frashauer, who shot African-American man Aaron Campbell and was temporarily suspended from the Portland police force. Frashauer was later reinstated to the force. Organizations like the Albina Ministerial Alliance claim that the settlement does not provide adequate prevention of excessive use of force. The Alliance has long advocated for social justice for African-Americans and other people of color in the Portland area. They want to see the settlement amended on several points. They want police to be prohibited from using force, such as weapons, dogs, and vehicles, as threats of violence, and they want new restrictions on tasers. They also object to the police policy of waiting 48 hours before officers are interviewed after they have used excessive force. Finally, they also want more community involvement in every aspect of police training. For more, I, Aaron J. Bernard, spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
Can you quickly take us through the highlights of the proposed settlement and what it would change about the way Portland police conduct business?
Well, the proposed settlement is in response to an investigation the Department of Justice did that found the police were using excessive force against people with mental illness. So there's a lot of changes that the police are supposed to be making to their force policies, to their training, to how they deal with people who are in mental health crisis or appear to be in mental health crisis, and some minor changes to the oversight system that's used to investigate and hold officers accountable. And most of those changes don't go far enough for what I think really is needed to make the changes that will keep these things from happening in the future, unfortunately.
Was Portland Cop Watch given the opportunity to offer input during the settlement process?
Well, we were part of the many, many people who came out and testified at the fairness hearing, which was, I think, one of the highlights of this entire process, that the judge listened to over 50 people come testify, and none of them said that everything is perfect the way it's written. Then the judge created these 13 questions, that the responses that just came out yesterday are responding to the judge's questions. That reflected that he really listened to most of the things the community was saying. I think there are some things that the judge didn't pick up on, which unfortunately aren't covered by any of the four parties' responses. And the main one I'm thinking of is that the agreement explicitly says that if you are shot by a Portland police officer, or if your loved one is shot and killed by a Portland police officer, and you want to file an appeal once the city says the officers were not out of policy, you can't do it. And we've called this to the attention of the Department of Justice before the settlement agreement was finalized by City Council. We've called this attention to the judge. We've been saying it over and over. And the only even thing that comes close to talking about that is the Department of Justice trying to defend themselves says that if a person files a lawsuit about a shooting and the officers found to have violated that person's constitutional rights, then there will be an investigation into whether the officer violated policy. But they're two separate issues.
Some opponents of the settlement are saying it has too many loopholes that might allow police to get around regulations. Do you share that concern?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think it's funny that the city referred to the people who testified at the hearing as objectors. I'd rather think that's a derogatory term. I think that we're being realistic by looking at the history of how the police and the city have circled their wagons whenever something happens that might cost them money. They find a way to interpret the rules in a way where they didn't do anything wrong.
Well, the Portland City Deputy Attorney has said that she believes means are already in place to fire and deal with officers who aren't conducting themselves appropriately. So it sounds like you're saying the track record doesn't really bear out that claim.
Right. And this is another frustrating thing about the city's response. And the difference between the city listening, not listening, and the judge actually listening. What was said at the hearing is that officers who use excessive and deadly force have never been successfully fired from their jobs or disciplined. And that is true, because even Officer Ron Freshour, who shot Aaron Campbell in the back, was fired, but he was forced to be reinstated by the state labor board. And the city's appealing that, but there's the discipline didn't stick. So the statement that was made by the public about that was true, and the city attorney chose to ignore the piece that we're talking about shootings and excessive force. It is true that officers have been fired for lying, cheating, stealing, and sexual misconduct, but that's not the same thing that the community is saying. Of course, we're happy when those officers get fired for those purposes, and nobody's disputing that that has happened, but it hasn't been for excessive force.
What would Portland Cop Watch like to see either put into or taken out of this settlement to give it more teeth?
How many hours do you have for this interview? Well, we definitely want to see that ability for people to file that appeal I talked about if there's a shooting. We definitely want to see that. We would like to see some of the things that the city actually seems open to in terms of lengthening the length of time that you have to have your appeal heard. If you disagreed with the outcome of an investigation, we wanted to see the oversight system be able to compel officer testimony, and there was a debate about that lasted between October and January that ended up with basically the oversight system now has to have an officer from the police bureau come in and say direct the officer under investigation to answer questions at the beginning of the interview, which is not the same thing as an independent investigation. So we want to see a true independent investigations. We want to see there are loopholes that they created around the uses of tasers and other uses of force. We want to see those eliminated, because they say you should not use tasers against people in a mental health crisis. And there's always like a little asterisk saying, except if blah, blah, blah is going on. And it's like, well, are we going to have a rule, or are we going to have a rule that has an exception that the officers are going to always use?
So how can people who are concerned about, say, this settlement or just the larger issue of Portland police conduct get involved and have their voices heard?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's one of the frustrating things about this being a process that's now in the hands of the court as opposed to being totally at the local level with our city council, because the only people who can approach the judge at this point are the four parties. That said, the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform has its own website, which is albinaministerialcoalition.org. You can find some information on there about how to get in touch with them. You can get in touch with us at Portland Cop Watch, and our website is portlandcopwatch.org. And you know, there's always the court of public opinion that is open to us as a means of expressing how we feel about the terms of this agreement. And according to the city itself, they're willing to change at least one of the terms that's in the agreement as soon as the agreement goes into place. The DOJ says, and the agreement itself says, that the agreement can be modified over the course of its five-year term, or however long it can last. It could be longer than that. So we all can help push things. The problem is, are we going to be limited by pushback from the city and the police association, who are saying, if you change even one word in this, the whole agreement that we made with each other is going to fall apart? Because I don't think we could live like that for 5 years or more.
So looking at the bigger picture, what is the Portland Police Bureau going to need to do to rebuild some of this lost confidence and trust with the public?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that they have done, which, you know, I'm always nervous about saying this, but I do like to praise the police for it. It has been 1 year and 8 days today since the last time the Portland Police have shot anybody in this city. And they have not quite made a record yet, because they have to wait. We have to wait until June to see that happen. But the fact is that they've been able to police this city without using deadly force for over a year, and I think that they can keep that up. And you know, that's the kind of thing that I think leads to the rebuilding of trust.
This has been Aaron J. Bernard speaking with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch about the controversy surrounding a proposed police brutality settlement agreement between the Department of Justice and the City of Portland, which Handelman says does not go far enough.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with a member of the Portland State University Student Union about today's strike authorization vote by university professors after this newscast, followed by Right to Survive at 6. Tonight's show focuses on women who are doing human rights work here in Oregon. The show is produced and hosted by the Women of the Right to Survive Collective. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be alternating clouds and sunshine with a high of 63, winds from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles an hour. The folks at radcast.org have temporarily suspended the daily radiation count until they are able to get more volunteers to support the effort. You can find more information on how to help at radcast.org.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The counselor advised an informal setting, adding that it is, quote, an effective way to build a better relationship. That sounds like advice that a love counselor might offer to couples, but not so. This relationship is about money. The counselor is a lobbyist for the healthcare industry, and he was explaining the art of wooing Congress critters by paying several thousand bucks to spend a weekend with them at some posh resort in Vail, Key West, or other luxury getaway. By holding what are called destination fundraisers outside of Washington, lawmakers and lobbyists can spend quality time together as they ski, snorkel, and schmooze. It's a way to get some large chunks of a lawmaker's time, oozed the lobbyist, who had recently enjoyed 3 days at the Four Seasons Resort in Vail with five Republican House members, two of whom are on the committee that writes our health laws. But wait, wasn't there a big stink over golf junkets a few years ago, forcing Congress to prohibit lobbyists from paying for these back-alley affairs? Yes, but Washington believes that where there's a will, there's a workaround. Here's how this one works. The lawmakers' political committees pay for their travel, food, booze, and lodging, so these expenses, technically, are not gifts from lobbyists. In turn, the favor seekers come at their own expense, plus making legal donations to the members' re-election campaigns. The donations end up being 3 or 4 times the cost of the event, so the lawmakers pocket a nice wad of cash, while the lobbyists enjoy a weekend of making legislative whoopee. Since the donations and the event are considered, quote, separate transactions, it's all legal. See? This is Jim Hightower saying, neither do I. In fact, what I see is just another corrupt way for corporations to buy Congress. Who do they think they're fooling?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A Supreme Court ruling earlier this week could affect thousands of miles of nature and bicycle trails all across the country. The justices ruled Monday that government easements for railroad beds over public and private lands expired once the railroads went out of business and must revert to original owners. The ruling came in a case brought by Wyoming landowners Marvin Brandt, whose 83-acre property was crossed by an old railroad line that was slated to become part of the Medicine Bow Rail Trail about 50 miles west of Laramie. The justices ruled 8-1 that government had received easements without any long-term land rights. For more information, KBOO News' Ken Jones spoke with Marianne Fowler, Senior Vice President of Federal Relations for the Rails to Trails Conservancy.
Marianne, the recent Supreme Court decision, what does it entail? It seems like it will cause some alarm among people who are using current trails and then some who are planning these trails.
Well, actually, Ken, it's a very limited, narrowly drawn opinion from the court, and it applies only to rail trails that were built on corridors that had been granted access across federal lands after 1875 and that had subsequently had private owners on either one or both sides of that corridor, and then subsequently the railroad ceased operation and a rail trail was developed on it. So that is the very small subset of rail trails in the country that could be affected by this decision.
So a small subset, you're talking about like 5% of the current trails, 10% of the current trails?
You know, we don't really know. And part of the reason for that is that the federal government has never kept accurate records of their federally granted rights of way. They have said that they, you know, would, with a railroad that operated under the auspices of the law after 1875, were to abandon their corridor, that land would revert to the federal estate, and the court has said, well, no, it won't. So that's what's at issue. And it's, you know, it's not a whole lot of rail trails, but we don't know how many. And we do know that some that aren't affected, and we also know that most of those that are affected are probably in the West because that's where the federal estate was.
Well, for instance, if a rail trail that was in the original 13 colonies, not affected at all because there was no federal estate in the 13 colonies because there was no federal anything in the 13 colonies.
Right.
If the rail trail is rail banked, then that law protects the rail trail, and so that type trail would not be affected by this decision.
No, I read that rail banking was actually upheld in the Supreme Court decision in 1990. What exactly is rail banking?
Rail banking, you know, when the Congress deregulated the rail industry in the late 1970s, they realized it would result in a lot of shedding of inventory from railroads as they sought to divest themselves of lines that they thought were no longer profitable. But Congress also saw that there was great value in preserving this corridor system, corridor network, you know, regardless of whether a train was running in it just now, that corridor could be used for train service or other types of uses in the future, and so there was value in preserving it. And the best way they came up with to achieve that preservation was to have trails in those corridors. And so if a railroad says they want to see service and puts a corridor up for abandonment, the first thing that happens is that if another railroad wants to
keep service going, then that they get first dibs. But if no railroad wants to run service, then, and there is a willing trail manager, and a trail manager is usually a state, a county, a city. It can be a non group of can be a nonprofit. And if they and the railroad reach terms, then ownership of the corridor is transferred to the trail manager, that who agrees to operate as a trail open to the public, but also agrees that if in the future it may be that corridor would be some railroad would want to restore rail service in the corridor.
Should we be expecting more lawsuits like the one that was brought before the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, I always expect lawsuits. In America, what can I say? We won't have one exactly like this one. I think that, you know, out west, it probably both trail managers and people who have property adjacent to rail trails are looking to see how they might be affected by this. So far, we've not heard of a single other trail other than the Medicine Bow in Wyoming, which the case is about, where they have indicated that they are affected. So we really don't know what's going to happen. I think the really important thing to remember is that almost every rail trail has a strong constituency of people who use it regularly. They love it. It's a part of their lives, and they're not going to want to lose that. And just as they found ways to build that rail trail in the first place, if it's impacted by this decision, they'll find ways to save it.
We've been talking with Marion Fowler, Senior Vice President of Federal Relations with the Rails to Trails Conservancy, about the recent Supreme Court decision affecting the conversion of abandoned railroad beds to public trails. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission recently got a briefing on how wolves have fared in the past year. The gray wolf is considered an endangered species under federal law in much of Oregon, and endangered statewide by Oregon law. For wolf lovers and livestock owners alike, there's good news and bad in the 2013 Wolf Conservation and Management Report. For more, we go to KBOO's Desiree Garcia in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
In Salem this week, the topic is the state of the gray wolf population in Oregon. The Fish and Wildlife Commission hears the annual wolf management figures for 2013. They'll learn that the state's wolf population has grown slightly, and there weren't many run-ins with livestock. Only 13 incidents were confirmed by ODFW as wolf-related, and ranchers lost 5 cows and 6 sheep. Rob Clavins with Oregon Wild describes the state's wolf management plan as a challenging compromise for all sides, but says the figures indicated appears to be working.
We're far from perfect, but we're doing the best job we can, and I think we're doing better than most states. We have a wolf plan that does allow the state to kill wolves on behalf of the livestock industry, but only as an option of last resort. And when you only have 64 wolves in the state, that makes a lot of sense.
Evans points out that 1/4 of Oregon's wolf population is still pups, and wolf recovery remains tenuous. There also were some wolf casualties in 2013, mostly from parvovirus, but one death by poaching in December that's still under investigation. 2 Oregon wolves were killed legally last year after crossing into Idaho, a state where wolves are shot for sport. The Idaho legislator is pondering spending $2 million to target more. Clavin says it's hard to make headway for wolf recovery when neighbors deal with the issue so differently.
That's really putting recovery in Oregon at risk, and what happens in Idaho matters in Oregon. And if you manage wolf populations to the absolute minimum required by law, that's really teetering perilously close to relisting wolves and putting them back on the endangered species list, and I don't even think that's what Idaho wants.
The 2013 report says Oregon has 8 wolf packs consisting of at least 4 wolves each, but only half of them meet the state species recovery criteria of having a breeding pair, a male, a female, and at least 2 pups. For KBOO News, I'm Desiree Garcia.
Advisors from Boeing will accompany a team from the National Transportation Safety Board to investigate the missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370. The most recent reports say that satellite images of possible debris from the missing Malaysia Airlines flight have been released on a Chinese government website. The images were taken on Sunday, a day after the plane disappeared, but were only released on Wednesday on the website of China's state administration. Previously, reports of oil slicks and floating debris, when investigated, provided no clues as to the plane's whereabouts. Once the location of the airplane is determined, International Civil Aviation Organization protocols will determine which country will lead the investigation.
According to a poll by the Pew Research Center, 61% of Republicans under 30 are in favor of same-sex marriage, and 31% are opposed. This indicates that the attitudes of young Republicans on this subject are more closely aligned with those of Democrats, regardless of their age. 69% of Democrats and independents support same-sex marriage. 17 states and the District of Columbia now allow same-sex marriage. This issue marked a division in Oregon's Republican Party this past weekend, when hardliners in the party refused to participate in the annual Dorchester Conference because of a plan to discuss the issue of gay marriage.
It's been nearly a year since a deadly factory collapse in Bangladesh caused some American retailers to demand more rigorous inspections. Workers' rights groups also called for improvements in garment industry facilities located in Bangladesh. New standards for periodic inspections and reports were set, along with the requirements that results be sent to factory owners and retailers supplied by the factory. The reports being released set a new standard for transparency and credibility. But the most recent inspection reports released Tuesday still show that many of the same dangerous safety violations continue to occur in numerous garment facilities in Bangladesh.
Dianne Feinstein, leader of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has accused the Central Intelligence Agency of unlawfully removing documents from computers that her committee used to complete a report on the agency's detention program. She charged the CIA with doing this in order to intimidate her committee. The CIA maintained it took the action to uncover how the committee gained access to the agency's internal review of the detention program. Speaking on the Senate floor, Feinstein charged the agency with violating federal law and seeking to undermine the constitutional right of Congress to oversee the executive branch.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a group of three suspected bombers in Kandahar were killed by security forces when they approached the provincial office of the security forces with bombs attached to their bodies. This follows the deaths of three polio vaccinators in Helmand province who were killed by a roadside bomb on yesterday. And today, the last Canadian soldier left Afghanistan after a dozen years of that country's military involvement in Afghanistan. Also on Tuesday, a British-Swedish journalist was shot dead by unknown gunmen in the Afghan capital, Kabul. In Washington today, the commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan, Major General Joseph Dunford, testified in front of a Senate committee about the potential for withdrawing U.S. troops by the end of this year.
What is the latest date that we can wait to, in order to find out if there's going to be a bilateral security agreement? In other words, the date that we must actually begin to implement a total withdrawal if there's going to be no BSA?
Chairman, I'll address that first from just a military perspective. Whether there would be a withdrawal at the end of 2014 or whether we would maintain a mission across Afghanistan and a regional approach at the end of 2014, I wouldn't do anything different between now and July. We've stabilized the force to support the elections in April, and we have plenty of flexibility to be able to adjust to either eventuality in July. Beginning in July, I think we have manageable risk during the months of July and August, and then I would assess the risk of an orderly withdrawal begins to be high in September, and that's simply a function of the tasks that have to be accomplished and how many days it needs to accomplish those tasks. But I would quickly add that what concerns me most about the delay in the BSA is not the physics of the retrograde or the redeployment of forces. It's the uncertainty that exists inside of Afghanistan with the Afghan people, the uncertainty with the Afghan forces, the hedging behavior that we see in the region, and as importantly, and I think something we need to be very attentive to in the coming months, the coalition cohesion in ensuring that at the end of these several months of uncertainty, we still have a coalition going into 2015.
Thank you.
That was testimony from NATO Commander Major General Joseph Dunford at the U.S. Senate in Washington today.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, March 12, 2014. Israeli troops injure 5 civilians in the West Bank and attack fishermen near Gaza coastline. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian sources reported that 5 Palestinian teenagers were injured on Wednesday during clashes with Israeli soldiers invading the southern West Bank town of Beit Umar near Hebron City. 3 boys were hit with live rounds fired by Israeli troops. Medical sources announced that the 3 were moved to Hebron City Hospital for treatment after sustaining serious wounds. 2 more teenagers were hit with rubber-coated steel bullets in their legs and were treated by field medics, local sources added. Elsewhere, Israeli bulldozers demolished on Wednesday morning residential homes and barracks belonging to the Palestinian community in the East Jerusalem town of Al-Izariya. According to local sources, the structures belong to Al-Jahalim Bedouin community. The house is the home of 10 members' family. In Gaza, Israeli naval boats opened fire at Palestinian fishermen. Local sources announced that the incident happened off the coastline of As-Sudaniyah, reportedly inside the 6-mile fishing zone, which is officially allowed by the Israeli authorities. The boats were severely damaged by artillery shell and additional gunfire. The fishermen managed to flee and there were no injuries reported among them. Late on Tuesday night, the Israeli Navy abducted and interrogated 2 Palestinian fishermen sailing along the coastline of Gaza on claims that they were sailing out of the Gaza allowed fishing range. Meanwhile, Al-Quds Brigades, the arming of the Islamic Jihad, announced that its fighters fired dozens of rockets from the Gaza Strip and landed in southern Israel on Wednesday, a day after an Israeli airstrike killed 3 Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip. The group said that the response has begun to the killing of 3 of its members on Tuesday. On Tuesday and Monday, Israeli attacks targeting Palestinian communities in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank left 6 killed, among them a Jordanian judge. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, March 12, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ken Jones, Jennifer Kemp, Desiree Garcia, Robin Ryan, and Sadia Khan. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO,
At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, guest host Lisa Loving talks with youth organizer Nicole Johnson from Opal about their upcoming Know Your Rights training and an update on their transit justice campaign. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts a special hour-long press watch, The News You're Not Supposed to Know. Senator Dianne Feinstein, of all people, has rounded out the CIA for trying to subvert congressional oversight. At 10, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, here are Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Nyman interviews writer Gina Frangello about her novel A Life in Men. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, we hear about the César Award-winning French film Ernest and Celestine, which was recently nominated for an Academy Award for Best Animated Feature. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Have a good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Working conditions of the faculty and the staff at Portland State University directly correlate to the learning conditions that the students face. We know that you don't want to strike, and we don't want you to have to strike, but if you are pushed into that corner, we will be standing here in solidarity.
Yeah, that was Raylene McMillan at the rally on the Park Blocks on February 27th. And welcome, Raylene McMillan, to our studio here at KPSU.
Hi, thanks for having me, Theo. I'm thrilled to be here today.
Yeah, we'll get to hear your warm studio voice as opposed to your rally voice. And, of course, in that excerpt there, you made the connection between the teacher welfare and the quality of our education. So this AAUP Professors Union contract negotiation isn't just about them having good jobs, is it?
No, it's not, Theo. I think that, the classroom environment is one that we all share. And what's good for one entity in the classroom is good for another. Folks have heard me say it a million times, and I'll say it a million more, that the working conditions, just like you heard in that excerpt, those working conditions of the people that are most responsible for our academic success. Well, we're, of course, most responsible for our academic success, but our partners in that success are the faculty and staff here at Portland State. And when they're taken care of, it's all the more likely that we're taken care of.
And right now that those teachers are in the bottom 10% of similar university situations, the fixed-term faculty are dealing with year-to-year contract renewals that they find out about near the end of each year.
Right.
So how can this be good for our education with a bunch of stressed-out faculty?
Right. Well, and, beyond just the isolated classroom experience that we may have term to term, what the bigger conversation is relationship-based learning being so important to our productivity as citizens once we leave this university.
Relationship-based learning?
Yeah, that's what I tend to call it. you spend a significant amount of time, depending on your program, with certain academic professionals and professors and academic staff. When you begin to head out into the world and you're looking for things like letters of recommendation for a mentor when you're making that transition from student to professional, are these folks going to still be around here, or are they going to be having been recruited by another university in another state somewhere where they're able to meet their own economic needs?
Students now pay with their tuition about 70% of the cost of the operating budget of this university, correct?
Absolutely.
So we're the bosses, in other words.
In a sense, yeah, I would say so. We are the largest financial stakeholders here at the university. And I would say that administration definitely does own the fact in many ways that students should have a rightful say. I will say this, that shared governance practices here at Portland State are quite sound, and students are given a voice in many, many decision-making processes here at Portland State. This contract situation, this contract negotiation timeline that we've been engaged in and will continue to be engaged in, it's part of a bigger picture, I would argue.
I use the comparison of my first school, Arizona State, which is not exactly a liberal stronghold. It's a pretty conservative state, but a long time, every state has that excuse right now. Education is being cut.
Absolutely.
A long time ago, Arizona somehow funded their basic level of funding at their universities has been at a more fundamental level since I went there. And, you know, Arizona State, the school I went to, has gone from 40,000 to 63,000, but the university just keeps growing in accordance with that population in terms of new buildings, new programs. The music school I went to is three times as big now. The whole campus is like that. So, I mean, we have to get out of the habit of saying, well, we're in tough times and the federal government doesn't want to fund education and Oregon doesn't want to fund education. It's still a matter of will. Where there's a will, there's a way.
I could not agree more, Theo. I think that Portland being the unique city that it is, and Portland State being the urban university that serves the city, we're presented with a unique opportunity right now. We have a chance to stand up. The administration of this university, the faculty, the staff, the students,
yeah.
We really are facing an opportunity right now to stand up and say no, that we're going to be that university that starts to kind of be that minnow that swims against the stream in this state of disinvestment in higher education. If we were to reprioritize here at home and begin to be a dissenting voice in this larger conversation about the despicable state of education funding, we can really make a difference. And I think Portland is a city that can happen in, and I would really love to see this university be the genesis of that movement.
Are you finding that students are becoming activists on this issue?
Absolutely.
Or what's your general feeling of the student pulse right now?
The student pulse we field the contract negotiations have been happening since April. I came into the mix in June when I took this position with ASPSU. And over time, gradually, I've felt nothing but support from my colleagues at ASPSU. But as the contract negotiations became a little bit more contentious, there was definitely more of a feel from the student body. And students began to slowly, at increasing rates, be popping into our office, asking questions. And now it is culminated in, my colleagues and I are fielding dozens of questions per day.
This is at the ASPSU student government offices.
Right in the front of Smith, 117. I guess I can go ahead and say, hey, keep coming in, students who are listening. We love answering your questions.
Watching the labor negotiations of the three unions here at PSU over the last 3 years as a student, I don't think I've ever seen a contract negotiation in a union as fed up right now as the teachers are. It hasn't been in the media yet so much, the general media, like it with the Portland Public Schools almost strike and
right.
City workers. But I think not that I'm rooting for that, but I think this is the negotiation that's closest to a strike in this city right now.
I've heard that argued as well by folks who have been around much longer. This is my first year here at Portland State. From what I understand, from multiple perspectives, I've spoken with folks, faculty, staff members, and administrators that would definitely agree with what you just said. I do think that it is make or break time, and this may just be me, but I'm feeling optimistic. We are returning to the bargaining table on Friday.
Okay.
Cameron Frank and I are the two student representatives
okay,
that
right.
are honored to sit in on those negotiations and observe them. And it, for the first time in a while, the union and the administration will be face-to-face once again. And
okay, not a mediator in between.
Right.
There will be a first time since October or November.
Yes. There will be a mediator there, but we will all be in the same room again.
Looking each other in the eye.
Yes, which, the students, I can say Cameron and I and the students that we represent as folks at that table are really happy that is the case. Get everybody back in the same room and really see if we can't come up with something that just serves the campus community.
And the other thing going on this week, of course, by the time you guys are back in the bargaining table on Friday, today and yesterday, the faculty union is voting on whether or not to do a strike authorization,
mm-hmm.
and they will announce the results of that tomorrow, Thursday morning sometime, I am told. So by the time you guys meet on Friday, if they do vote to authorize a strike, there'll be that little extra pressure for both sides, really, to get serious about negotiations.
Absolutely. And I think, there is a misconception out there. Students are wondering, are they voting on whether they're going to strike or not? And I think it's an important detail to point out that they're voting to authorize a strike.
Right.
If they were to authorize a strike, it doesn't mean our teachers are definitely going on strike. It's definitely just you know, they're gauging member sentiment right now and moving through the legalities that they need to move through in the event that they need to take that step.
They have to authorize it before they can strike under state law for
absolutely
universities.
Yeah, there's an entire timeline. Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, PECBA. I do encourage students who are interested in the legalities of this to, I'm sure a Google search for PECBA would tell you most of what you need to know.
This is labor law that was passed for just Oregon public entities, or at least Oregon universities. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us a little bit about ASPSU's stance of support?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm happy to say that not at our last Senate meeting this week, but 2 weeks ago, the ASPSU Senate deliberated. Of course, they've been staying posted via myself keeping up with the ongoing negotiations as a body and as individuals. And after some deliberation, we voted to adopt a stance of support of AAUP during any potential strike authorization activity, which at the time it was potential. Now they are engaging in that strike authorization vote. And in the event that they do strike, we've got a supportive stance. Now, that's not necessarily, we haven't adopted any action items. It's a stance of support. We're not looking at this as a versus match in any way.
A versus match?
I guess that's a funny way to put that. We're not interested in taking a side per se and demonizing the administration of this university. We understand that all sides have difficult decisions to make. But what our stance means is it was important to us to showcase to our teachers that we recognize the solidarity that's necessary in the classroom environment and the success, that our success is their success and vice versa. It was really important to us to make a statement to that effect.
And I just want to back up a bit when we were talking about student reactions or student support right now. I remember you saying at the rally that at least at one point, for some reason, you had like 300 emails in your inbox?
Yeah, well, I didn't, 300, I said hundreds in plural. It may have been close to 300. I didn't, you know, end up counting. First it was dozens hours, and then it was hundreds.
Oh, and that was over, was that a one-time event over the rally, or does that keep happening?
They're coming in a little more slowly now. Those ones that came in were in the first few days that ASPSU sent out the first executive update that per that newsletter that I was mentioning earlier. It went out. It was quite a long letter from me. Students who read that whole thing, thank you. Side note, I know it was long. There was a lot to be shared. Folks read it, and like I said at the rally, dozens and then hundreds of emails floated into my personal inbox because I included a note at the end that said students who would like, you know, any questions, any information. I didn't quite realize what I was getting into in that. It was a phenomenal way to gauge student input, though. And of those hundreds of messages, there were, of course, a handful of students who felt differently, but I would say the grand majority, by far the majority, were notes of solidarity and, notes of support for teachers, students asking, how can I get involved? How can I help? What's going on? What it did for me and for a lot of my colleagues in ASPSU was cemented that feeling of, you know, we are representative of the student body, right? It's really hard to gauge a campus of 29 to 30,000 individuals, but when we see a self-selecting group like that, just returning, returning an email with notes of, hey, we're in this together, let's do this. We really felt like, okay, you know what, it's time to take a stance. If that was the response to that email, let's move forward and do what we can to represent student interest on this.
Well, it's really good to see different student activist groups and the student government and the faculty union, or all the employee unions, starting to work together.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a phenomenal union coalition here on campus. We're called Together for PSU, and in it, delegates from the organizations ASPSU, the Student Action Coalition, better known as STAC, and then both of our faculty unions, AAUP and PSUFA, and our staff union, SEIU, we all send, you know, a couple delegates to that table. Our union coalition is strong. This is definitely a good university for folks who are passionate about organized labor.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Raylene McMillan, University Affairs Director of ASPSU, we thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Theo.
And
so, yeah, if folks are interested in what ASPSU is presenting to the board, I encourage you to check out their agenda, check out the minutes from this meeting. You can see what I've talked with them about.
Well, thanks, Raylene McMillan.
Thank you, Theo.
Yeah.
You've been listening to an interview with Raylene McMillan, who is a member of the Portland State University Student Union. The interview was conducted by Theo Burke of KPSU. Teachers at Portland State University held a strike authorization vote today. We'll bring you the results of that vote on tomorrow's news. Polls of teachers indicate that it is likely that they will vote to authorize a strike. If no agreement is reached between the teachers' union and the management, a strike could begin as soon as March 27th. More information can be found on the website wearepsu.org. Stay tuned now for the Right to Survive Radio. Tonight's show focuses on women who are doing human rights work in Oregon. The show is produced and hosted by the Women of the Right to Survive Collective.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Bear Witness, a storytelling night to celebrate the release of Extra Tough No. 6.75, Report from UYAC Bay, Thursday, March 20th, 7 p.m. at the Jack London Bar, 529 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. Bear Witness features Vanessa Rennick, Laura Messersmith-Glavin, Mo Baustern, Judith Arcana, and Tim Griffey. Again, that's Thursday, March 20th at 7 p.m. at the Jack London Bar. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with services 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM, Philomath and Corvallis. Now, Right to Survive.
You're listening to Right to Survive Radio on KBOO 90.7 in Portland. I'm Ibrahim Mubarak of Right to Survive. On this show, we go to Ground Zero, Portland, Oregon, and report news and stories that corporate media don't cover. We'll bring the uncut reality from the perspective of the unhoused community.
This is Lisa Fay with Right to Survive Radio. R2S Radio goes into the houseless community, making their voices heard, speaking to individuals on subjects that directly relate to their daily struggles.
Somebody help me.
That's work.
This is not healthy.
Oh, man.
I am not my fear.
What I do, have the power to break the chains.
Doing what's right, you.
And I come back even stronger. Not a novice any longer. Cause you deepen the conviction in my soul. Well, yes, I am wise. But it's wisdom on the pain. Yes, I pay the price. But look how much I gain.
This is Ibrahim Mubarak. We at Right to Survive want to thank you for tuning in to our radio show on KBOO 90.7 FM. This month, the Women of Right to Survive interview and produce today's show for National Women's Month. You'll be hearing conversation with women from Portland, Oregon and Vancouver, Washington about human rights issues. Stay tuned for a wonderful show. Thank you.
So if you want to state your name and the organization you're with.
I'm Monica Weitzel, and I work with the Portland Women's Crisis Line.
How did you get involved in this type of work?
I started working at Portland Women's Crisis Line after volunteering at a place called Rose Haven. I was working in makeup, and I started to volunteer to do makeup and self-care groups at Rose Haven, which is a day center for women and children experiencing houselessness or poverty. And through working with that organization, I came to be connected to a lot of folks that had been impacted by domestic and sexual violence. And after hearing their stories and getting information about where they sought support, I learned about PWCL, and I learned that a lot of these folks relied on PWCL to provide them support and navigating the experience of houselessness as well as the experience of surviving domestic and sexual violence. Then I started volunteering at Portland Women's Crisis Line, and when the position came up to provide advocacy specifically to survivors of domestic and sexual violence experiencing houselessness, I applied for that and was lucky enough to get hired.
So DV is a contributing factor into homelessness. How many shelters are there in Portland that you know of?
For domestic violence?
Yes.
We check 9 domestic violence shelters, but that extends beyond Portland. So that would extend to Washington County, Clackamas County, and Clark County.
Okay, what is the likelihood of getting into these shelters?
It's really difficult to predict when shelter space is going to open up. And as I'm sure you know, there is a much, much larger need than a shelter's capacity to fill it. So I've worked with people that just because of timing, they've been unable to access shelter in a domestic violence supportive system for many, many, many months. And then every once in a while, I'll get someone that calls that day and gets into shelter. And that's incredible.
Okay, so that's one of the challenges that is a challenge for women to get out of their domestic violence situation. So what are other challenges that women face?
When leaving domestic violence?
Yeah, when choosing to leave.
Well, I think that when an individual is experiencing domestic and sexual violence, it oftentimes, the relationship doesn't begin that way. So a lot of times I'll talk to folks that will identify that when they first met this person that they now come to see as their abuser, that individual was incredible. That person was charming. And there's a lot of love there and a huge feeling of loss and confusion and emotional pain. A lot of times there's an abuse that happens over time, and by the time someone is ready to leave a domestic violence situation, their support system has been damaged. They have experienced financial abuse. They are isolated. Maybe their abuser has made it impossible for them to access a phone. So in addition to there being a lack of systemic support available and an inability of DV services to meet the needs of these individuals, there's also a kind of stripping of power or perceived power that can happen when a survivor is in a domestic violence relationship that can make it challenging for them to navigate what resources are available. I would say too, as we know, domestic